Good evening, everybody. Note that the talk I prepared, I didn't print it out. That's okay. So forums are on my mind because I was last week at Tassajara Monastery, which is kind of like our lineage family's like forums storehouse, living laboratory of forums. And I had a few in mind, and now I just thought of another one. So let's just decide. Do you think that when we start the talk, the people in the Do-on Ryo and the Ino and the Tenkan, should they move out to the seats in the body of the thing, or is that just too much fuss to move around? Because otherwise, I gotta like, or I can just ignore you. It's okay?
Yeah.
All right, okay, decision made.
Yeah. Yes, and it would be easy to do when there are seats available.
Might not be seats, yeah. Awkward. Yeah, it's a popular place. It might not be seats. Okay, all right, decision made. So there we go, forms evolving in action. So the couple of forms that I was reminded of, are you going to be able to hear me over the fan? Is it better to have cool or? Okay, all right, I'll try to speak up. A few that I was reminded of was I went to the Zazen instruction meeting in the Zendo there. And this is in California, in the mountains behind Big Sur, beautiful place. And he was reminding us in the Zazen instruction the importance of the mudra. So I just thought I'd remind us all about what I was reminded about the mudra. That it kind of mirrors shashu, it kind of like shashu opening up. So the right hand is on the bottom, the left hand is on the top, and the knuckles are kind of lined up, thumb tips very gently touching and making a little oval. But also, he was emphasizing not like lying around, you know, like something you sort of forgot, you know, but held with a little bit of energy and a little bit of liveliness, gently up against the body. And the full form is that it's actually not even really resting on anything, but I think that's like a little too much strain, you know what I mean? So my compromise is just gently touching your belly or a little fold in your clothing or just a little bit of support from whatever it's touching, but to really kind of keep some energy there. And I remember last time Norman was here, he reminded us of a line from Keizan Jokin, that you hold your mind in your hands. That's nice, huh? Hold your mind in your hands. So. And it's interesting, sometimes the mudra acts as kind of like a little indicator gauge. You know, if you're falling asleep, you might look down and it's kind of like, if you're like really worried about something, really tense, you might look. So you can kind of have a feedback loop between the mudra and your mind and your heart. Anyway, just keep a little more energy there with a nice reminder. The other form I was reminded of was when you enter the room, they have a nice little form I forgot all about. Pay attention to which foot crosses the threshold. Only Zen would ever think of this, you know. So the idea is to cross the threshold with the foot closer to the hinges of the door. So on the way in, and we have a nice threshold, so that's pretty clear. On the way in, the right foot comes out first. On the way out, the left foot comes first. So I'm going to try to practice with that. Am I going to correct anybody? That's the wrong foot! No, you know. But you might if you're interested. Just one more little thing. Like, oh, and with all of these, we can bring a spirit of, you know, okay, just another little way to kind of wake up and remember what I'm doing and what's happening this moment. Or the mind can come up with the spirit of, what a stupid rule. Are they kidding? You know? You can decide which spirit you like. And then also, when I'm doshya, there's a little, I'm going to try to remember to turn. I'm trying to turn the wrong way when I'm doshya, well, wrong, right and wrong. But so I'm that's just a little form for me. Like, turn. And all my colleagues at Samish were turning this way too, so we can turn this way. I will, just for fun. Well, the idea is that the bare shoulder is like kind of a little naked and risque. And so you keep the covered shoulder towards the Buddha. So, it's only one way to explain this. So, I mean, this is just the doshi. So after you bow, you feel like, I have been turning this way, but that's like, so a little more formal way, which they do there, and I noticed my colleague at Sandwich were also doing a turn this way. Anyway. So next time, you end up a Zen priest being officiating, you'll know which way to turn. But it's a beautiful place, and a place, you know, a powerful sort of focused practice, especially in the wintertime, when they have their three-month monastic training periods, one in the fall and one in the spring. And then in the summertime, they have workshops and guests and a pool and wonderful food. So I was there. I was there to lead one of the workshops and support a few of the guests who were there. So the guests, instead of just lying around at the pool, would have a little something else to do. So excuse me, I'm just going to see if I can bring up my talk here on my gadget. And if not, I've got to come up with something. Oops. You have a laptop here? Let's see if I can do this. So one of the things I did while I was at Tassajara was I bought a book at a bookstore. You can shop. So you can't talk on your cell phone. You can't watch TV or anything like that. No screens whatsoever, completely cut off. Like one of the few places left, you know, in the country where there's no cell phone service. But they do have a little bookstore. And so the book that I got is a book by one of our Dharma colleagues named Renshin Bunce. And it's a book about her time there. And at the other centers of San Francisco Zen Center. So I was going to end my talk, here it is, with this, and maybe I still will, if this needs, yeah, maybe I'll start my talk with that and see if my little gadget wants to load my talk. But basically, being a person is pretty interesting. On the one hand, things are pretty tough. We have these minds that are so prone to narrowness and reactivity and a sort of over-focus on some things that we think will make us happy, which maybe they do, maybe they don't. We come and under-focus on some of the things that actually are helpful to us. And when we start meditation practice, sometimes it's kind of like a little bit shocking, right? You start to notice the prevalence of your whirling discursive thoughts, and maybe you're noticing that just now, the way the mind's bouncing all over the place. So on the one hand, practice is interesting because maybe here we find, you know, some kind of way, some kind of tool for being with this aspect of our living, the sort of crazy-making aspect of being a person with a mind. You know, all the things that we grasp at and get mad about and get tangled up in. And sometimes we talk about, back to the forms, the way the forms and this kind of ritual way of being together is like almost designed to like trigger some of that nasty stuff and make us work with it in a context in which it's just like sort of extra funny. Because why does it really matter that much, you know, which way we turn or which foot crosses the threshold, right? So we set up something with a lot of meaning that's artificially created by us, you know, and agreed on by us and maybe tradition and so on. And then we react a little bit to it. So on the one hand, being a person is pretty tough. And so the stability, the focus, the settledness and the groundedness of Zazen can kind of help us, you know, work with this, you know. So there's a way that we're kind of broken, and maybe practice will help us to heal and grow. And on the other hand, what's the problem anyway? It's great, you know, to be alive, isn't it? To just breathe, to have friendship, to have, you know, sunrises and sunsets, to just be able to feel our presence, you know, in space, to fall in love, to know about things like art and literature and joy. Oh, look, here's my talk, maybe. Let's see. I stalled long enough. More or less saying what I was going to say. So on the other hand, maybe there's no problem whatsoever. And maybe the Dharma is the support for just remembering, just feeling, just returning to sort of the still point, to the source. That worked. The Zazen can help us to sort of touch, you know, this basic beautiful reality of just being alive, being connected. And, you know, I'm lately into the science of mindfulness and compassion and you know, stress. And science is learning that in addition to our finely tuned reactivities, to our panic, our fight and flight response, to our little bit of sort of built-in negativity and worry, our bodies and our nervous system are also wired up to for thriving, for joy, for connection, for altruism, that we're actually also evolved to be compassionate and kind. So it's interesting the way our life has these two aspects, you know. And one will dominate at some one time, and then we touch into the other. This quality of the difficulty of life, and this quality of the completeness and the joy, and just the simplicity of life. And so maybe ultimately really what practice is about is stabilizing us enough and opening us up enough, encouraging our curiosity enough that we can actually kind of start to hold both of these aspects of being alive. The damaged, confused, you know, difficult aspects and the whole, complete, peaceful aspect. And, you know, maybe practice can support us and be able to move a little more gracefully between these. Like we like to think about and talk about balance and equanimity. But what do we mean by balance and equanimity? Does that mean there's some way that we can sort of find this perfect midpoint, you know, and just stay there? Or is balance sort of an average? You know, we go this way, we go that way, the swings get smaller for a while, depending on conditions. The swings get really big for a while, but we're able to swing, to dance with this. And one of the things I appreciate that I think Zen practice really points out is that this kind of learning, this learning to dance with both aspects of this, is really something that we can't understand fully on our own. Much as we try, right? Much as we try so hard to figure it out, be independent, be our own person, take care of ourselves, be responsible. It seems like we really need relationship, community, and culture to understand this. And so maybe that's part of what we're trying to do here, is create a community and a culture that supports that kind of understanding, that ability to move fluidly through all the seasons of our lives, moment to moment, day to day, year to year. So it's really wonderful that we have sitting groups like this. And so, yeah, so I was really thinking about how I was gone these last 2 weeks, and I was so grateful to be here tonight and to see how smoothly things are running, as always here, you know, everyone doing their roles. And big thank you to everyone who did things these last couple of weeks. I can be in and out a little bit all summer. But what's interesting is that the last 2 weeks that I was away, I was in two different examples of intensive practice. That sort of mirroring these two aspects of our life, we have sort of two qualities of practice. On the one hand, it's good for a time to take up very intensive practice, really putting ourselves in kind of a strong container, kind of a cauldron where, you know, we're practicing from early to late, where it's challenging, where stuff's coming up, where there's a lot of support too. And, you know, so one of our ways of doing intensive practice is a couple of times a year, and especially once a year in June, we have our longest intensive retreat that our Sangha organizes. And if you weren't there, I'll just report briefly. It went really well, as far as anybody can tell. Who knows what well means, but a lot of people there, a lot of gratitude from especially people who traveled the distance, and we, you know, were the hosts. So we really created this opportunity for more people than just those of us from Red Cedar who were able to be there this year. We created it for people from, you know, New York, New Jersey, California, Montana, Arizona, somewhere else probably I'm forgetting.
Puerto Vallarta.
Puerto Vallarta, yeah, Puerto Colorado. Vallarta. Colorado, yeah, right, yeah, lots of people from all over the world, all over the place. So that was one example of a sort of intensive container of practice, and then Tassajara I was just mentioning. This time of year in Tassajara, the practice is a little less sort of formally strict, but nonetheless, someone was running around with a little bell, waking up everyone, including these highly paying guests, at 5 in the morning. And then we had an hour-long period of zazen, in the Zen hall at, I forget when, 5:20, I think. They had a little bell in the middle. You could change your posture. And so the guests that I was shepherding through my workshop, part of my workshop was to invite them to come to the Zen hall and experience this sort of little burst of intensive Zen practice. Then we got together in a separate building to kind of like debrief and see what we learned from it. And it was really interesting. They learned a lot. There was an hour of meditation. There was a service. And then there was a soji, temple cleaning, kind of like we do here on Saturday morning and during retreats. They do there every morning, very intensive 15-minute burst of work. And it's actually like really logistically important to them too. So they got it down, man. You get your assignment quick. You're in your job within minutes, you know. So within minutes of exiting the zendo, I'm in the kitchen chopping potatoes and surrounded by several other people who maybe had never even been in this kitchen. Pretty small kitchen, too. Puts out hundreds of meals a day. And so it was interesting, some of the things that they learned from this. I mean, they had interesting experiences in the meditation itself, but also in the service and especially in the soji, in the work time, in the cleaning time. One person said the first day they were sure that they were doing everything wrong and everybody around them thought they were a total idiot, and, you know, just they got some glance that they interpreted in silence, you know, and it's early and it's also hot, actually. Even at 6 in the morning, it's in the high 80s probably. And then the next day, somebody smiled at them. They could feel that everyone around were kind and supportive and, you know, wow, what a nice thing Zen is. You know, same person, same experience, you know, from the outside. So we have these sort of intensive opportunities to practice and to have things come up from both of those sides, right? There's those two sides again. That side of contentment and completeness showed up for that person, and that side of inadequacy and discomfort and fear showed up in the same kitchen with the same chopping, you know. Who knows? And then we also have gentler times of practice, and that's what I love about what we do here, that most of the year, you know, most of us are coming here once a week, maybe some of us a couple times a week. We're trying to practice, you know, maybe 20 minutes, half an hour a day at home, more or less, depending on our schedule and our proclivity. We're trying to be a little more aware throughout the day. We're trying to be a little kinder, trying to find ways to make practice a part of our lives. And, you know, it's interesting, when we first started the group in the early 90s, I didn't really fully recognize the value of that kind of practice. So it's been beautiful for me, little by little, just kind of get it through my head that that is equally valid and equally important, and I think we really need both. So I really want to encourage all of us, when you have a chance, you know, do both. You do the gentle practice for, you know, most of the year, probably for us, with jobs and families. But then set aside time, you know, save up vacation, save up money, make it work somehow to come to our week retreat, to go to another center, to, you know, to go visit a place like Tassajara. And maybe one of these years we'll organize a little Sangha trip down there. It's a pretty amazing place, deep in the mountains, very, very beautiful. And so I think once we add all this together, it's interesting, because even though Zen has this powerful reputation towards a sort of intensity, a certain kind of coldness almost, a kind of willingness to just get in there, like we say in Zen, study your suffering, you know, root out the
these aversive habits and these, you know, ways that you create more trouble for yourself. You know, notice that second dart that you shoot at yourself, that famous story of the Buddha. You know, it sounds like sort of almost clinical sometimes, the way Zen is portrayed. But I think when you really put these two sides of human experience and these two qualities of practice together, it's really more about connection, aliveness, and love. And love. That in the end, Zen supports us in these interesting ways, being more fully in love with the world, or in the world, but in a way that's real, you know, in a way that's rooted in awareness, in a way that's rooted in honesty, in a way that includes suffering, includes pain, includes joy, includes the ways that we're broken and the ways that we're complete. Which somehow brings us back to Dogen. Because I think Dogen understood this. He had his funny way of saying it. And he has given us his advice for how bodhisattvas should practice, which off and on I've been reading from his essay, Bodhisattva's Four Methods of Guidance. So that we'd return one more time to Four Methods of Guidance and see if we can finish it, as if we could finish anything. So remember, the first of his four methods for how to practice in this way as a person devoted to awakening, devoted to Bodhi, Bodhisattva, is the practice of giving. The practice of giving. And he reminds us to have a very wide view of what giving is and can be. Not to focus too much on whether we're giving the right things or giving enough stuff or doing it right, doing it wrong. Not to focus so much on the thing as an object and the person receiving as another object, but to focus on the practice and the process of giving. And he says in there that giving can be just about anything. He says, give a phrase, give a verse. This will be a wholesome seed for this and other lifetimes. Give your valuables. Give a penny. Give a blade of grass. This will be a wholesome root for this and other lifetimes. The truth will turn into valuables. The valuables will turn into truth. And this is because the giver is willing. Is willing. Isn't that beautiful? So to work on our willingness to give. And he talks in there about how it's too narrow when we separate ourselves from the gift and from the giver and from the receiver. And he says that even being in a body, even being in a body, you're already giving if you pay attention and you feel into what it is to be embodied. He says in there, if you study giving closely, you see that to accept a body and to give up the body are also giving. So what would that be to really understand receiving a body is a way to give, and giving up the body, dying, is also an act of giving. And all this giving attitude, giving practice, giving spirit helps others. So this is the spirit of the bodhisattvas, to help others. And it helps them in a really powerful way, regardless of how we're sort of thinking about the gift. He says in there, even when you give a particle of dust, that's a good gift, huh? Hi, I've got some dust. Even when you give a particle of dust, you should rejoice in the act. Because you have authentically transmitted the merit of all Buddhas and practiced an act of a bodhisattva. And then he says, the mind of a sentient being is very difficult to change. That's true, huh? 12th century. You could see this, you know. The mind of a sentient being is very difficult to change. But you will keep on changing the minds of sentient beings from the moment you offer one gift to the moment that they attain the way. So we talked about that. Does that sound familiar, giving? Then he gives two more variations on giving, which I'll just mention briefly. The second and the third of his four methods of practicing as a bodhisattva are kind speech and beneficial action. So I think mostly he was highlighting these two qualities of giving. And it's interesting, Buddhism from the get-go really paid a lot of attention to speech. You know, and that English expression we have, sticks and stones will never harm you, right? Not that. You know, not that understanding at all, that speech is powerful, words are powerful. So So it says in there, if kind speech is offered, little by little, kind speech expands. So it just grows. Thus, even kind speech that is not ordinarily known or seen comes into being. Be willing to practice this for your entire life. Do not give up. World after world, life after life, those who hear kind speech from you will have a delighted expression and a joyful mind. Those who hear of your kind speech will be deeply touched, and they will always remember it. So yeah, you hear about Zen, that's not what you think of, huh? Some little phrase like that from a Zen master. Just speak kindly. And again, it's like just like with his little essay on giving, can you hear the little release there from the sort of self-conscious, sort of plodding way that we go about things, you know? Give anything, give dust, you know, give grass, and trust that that's a huge gift. So trust that any kind speech will grow, will expand, will evolve. So, you know, we do have to be somewhat self-aware, of course, you know, choose our words wisely. But it might be we can release a little bit from this tremendous burden of a kind of self-consciousness that we have, right? Ah, I gotta say, what are you supposed to say? And especially in some of these bigger situations of giving, like when somebody's dying, right? You're entering that room, part of your discursive mind, and here's that one part of you, wants to know the right thing to say, right? The right thing to do, the right gift to give. Dogen says, just trust, right? Just say something kind. It will expand, it will grow, it will touch the whole world. And similar when he talks about his third method of beneficial action. And here the emphasis is on harmony with others. So these are all very relational, very relational. And this is in what we chant sometimes. I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Sangha before all beings, bringing harmony to everyone. So this is a real gift, right? The gift of harmony, the gift of beneficial action. And, you know, this is interesting, too, to think about the sort of relative way that we go in and out of, you know, feeling strong and self-aware and centered. You know, when we're feeling good, it's maybe a little feels easier to bring harmony and connection to into our relationships, into the room, into our phone call, into our email, into the many, many ways we're communicating, across the counter at the grocery store. But what about when we're in a grouchy mood, you know? What about when we're in a really crappy mood? Then how do we practice this? What about when the person in front of us is somebody we do not like? We do not think is worthy of our kindness. We don't want to bring harmony to them. I ran into a little quote here from Martin Luther King Jr., which is basically on this beneficial action. I don't think Martin Luther King Jr. ever heard of Dogen, but nevertheless. He said one time, discover the element of good in your enemy. Every time you begin to hate this person, realize there is good there. Look at those good points, which will overbalance the bad point. There is a recalcitrant south of our soul revolting against the north of our soul. There is something within each of us that causes us to cry out with Goethe. There is enough stuff in me to make both a gentleman and a rogue. There's enough stuff in me to make a gentleman and a rogue. So that sense of connection, you know, there's compassion, right? That's really a statement of compassion. So another sort of maybe a synonym for beneficial action is compassion, compassion action, harmony, connection, human to human, right? Each of us, seeds of joy, seeds of hate, seeds of confusion, complete, inadequate. And we're with another human being just like me, right? Just like that. So here's what I was hoping to get to. See if I can get it done in time. The last of his four methods is really interesting. I feel like I could bend so long, I figured we'd better touch on the first three or wouldn't know what he's talking about. The last of his four methods, and this feels like one of the sort of teachings and understandings that Buddhism is particularly given as a gift to humanity. This he calls identity action. Identity action. So it has to do with the skillful use of identification. And we tend to identify with things automatically and unconsciously, sometimes in helpful ways, sometimes in ways that cause tremendous suffering, right? We identify with all kinds of things like bad qualities and things that are, you know, not going to stick around and things that aren't here and who knows what. So Dogen suggests we can become more deliberate about what we identify with. And one way to think about this is the practice of entering and exiting from roles, moving fluidly between different roles to feel into what are the ways that we can be most helpful. And there's a real sense of humility in this practice of identity action that I think is really, really baked into the Bodhisattva archetype and enacted in our practice. That the Bodhisattva is perfectly as willing to clean the toilet as she is to give the Dharma talk or officiate at the service or fix the website or, you know, help somebody with their car, you know. That the Bodhisattva steps into the role that's most helpful in a way that is, you know, often quiet, often unself-conscious. And therefore, the Bodhisattva is also able to step out of that role when it's no longer helpful. And here's where we often fall down, though. We get really good at our role, and maybe our role has some very wise and altruistic aspects to it, and maybe it made a lot of sense 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, but here we are, you know, here we are, maybe ignoring the ways that we have changed, the ways that people around us have changed. And here's a great advantage to the long time arc of Sangha practice. We start to see, oh, she's changed, I've changed. I don't have to play this role anymore. I can change to something else. And Norman talks about this really beautifully in his, I think it was his first book about Dharma, called Taking Our Places, The Buddhist Path to Truly Growing Up. So if you haven't read that, that's a wonderful book. I forget when it was published, late 80s maybe. Taking Our Places, The Buddhist Path to Truly Growing Up. And I was wondering to myself if it was in our library. So you know what I did? I went online and searched our library catalog. And sadly, it wasn't there. So, but thanks to Chris, I could do that. I checked on the website, practice library, and then I went to the library thing, and there was our entire catalog with little pictures and reviews, and it was awesome. But not this book. So if you have a copy you want to donate or you want to buy a copy for the library, it'd be great to have a few copies. Anyway, here's what Dogen says about this identity action. This willingness to sort of meet the world in a strong way, a dignified way, in a skillful way. What form should I take, right? Which form should I take? That's what he means. Dogen wrote, action means the right form with dignity and correct manner. This means that you cause yourself to be in identity with others, causing others to be in identity with you. However, the relationship of self and others varies limitlessly according to circumstances. So maybe I should have just said that for the whole talk. Sorry. Let's unpack it just a little bit. Action means right form, dignity, correct manner. This means that you cause yourself to be in identity with others after causing others to be in identity with you. However, the relationship of self and other varies limitlessly according to circumstances. So, no one way, right? That's a Suzuki Roshi expression, no one way. Always changing. Sometimes this involves doing what comes naturally. Sometimes it's easy to fall into a skillful identity action. Other times the world stretches us, right? We're called upon to kind of get over ourselves or rise out of some perceived limitation, to work with some fear, some limit that we've placed on ourselves. And, you know, life offers us so many training as identity action, and there's also ways that the roles we play at the Zendo help us to learn about this. But Dogen paints an even bigger picture of this. He says in his kind of poetic way, using mountains, that if we don't cooperate with identity action, there's a way the whole world is going to be a little akimbo, a little messed up. He says, the ocean, mountains and water, the ocean does not refuse to be water. That's why it's so large. Think about it. The ocean is like, I don't want to be water, you know. Not today, you know. I'm not in the mood to be water, right? The mountain does not refuse the soil. That's why it is high. A wise lord does not exclude people. That's why he has many subjects. This being so, water comes together to form the ocean. Soil piles up to form the mountains. Because the mountains do not refuse to be mountains. They are mountains and they are high. Because the Lord is not weary of the people assemble. Presumably the people have joy. So it's not just for our own benefit that we practice identity action, but so that the whole world, you know, the whole world can be in more harmony. So I guess I'll have to save Ren's book for next time. I think I'll close with another story. There's some great stories in here, like very realistic stories about practicing with identity action in the monastery. Which basically means that she was upset a lot. It's difficult, you know. I'll tell you more later. And beautiful, too. Beautiful, too. In her case, she worked in the kitchen. And some days they had harmony. Some days, not so much. So here's a story, actually, that Norman quoted. And I want to share with you, because it's such an amazing story. And we'll close with this. And I'm sorry, we'll just go a couple minutes over nine. Not many, though. He told the story of Robert, a French surrealist poet who was active in the 30s and 40s, named Robert Desnos, half Jewish, and he stayed in France, in South France, in the Vichy. And eventually, he would try to be in the resistance, but eventually he was caught by the Nazis and imprisoned in a concentration camp. And the story goes, one day, along with many others from the camp, Robert Desnos was taken in a truck away from the barracks where he had been held prisoner. So they're being transported somewhere. Leaving the barracks, the mood is somber because everyone knows that the truck is headed for the gas chamber. And when the truck arrives, no one can speak. Even the guards fall silent. But this silence is soon interrupted by an energetic man who jumps into the line and grabs one of the condemned. Improbable as it is, my friend told me, Desnos, the poet, starts to read this man's poem. Oh, he says, I see you have a very long lifeline, and you're going to have 3 children. He's exuberant, and his excitement is contagious. First one man and then another offers up his hand to be read, and the prediction each time is for longevity, more children, and abundant joy. As Desnos reads more poems, not only does the mood of the prisoners change, but that of the guards too. How can one explain it? Perhaps the element of surprise has planted a shadow of doubts in their mind. If they told themselves these deaths were inevitable, they no longer seem inevitable. And they are in any case so disoriented by the sudden change of mood amongst those that they were about to kill that they are unable to go through with the execution. So all the men, along with Desnos, are packed back in the truck and taken back to the barracks. Desnos has saved his own life and the lives of the others by using his imagination. And I was thinking, not just imagination, but there's an example maybe, a sort of wild example of this identity action. Somehow he intuited a role. You could have the role of waiting in line to be murdered, or you can take up this role of the exuberant poem reader. You know? Unbelievable. And I don't know if there's historical documentation that this really happened or not, but it's a story that's been told, I guess, since that time. But sadly, Robert Desnos, he did survive the war. The camp was liberated. But a couple of days later, he died of typhus. So these practices don't give us magical happy endings, but they allow us to engage this world, to move between, you know, what sometimes in Buddhism they call the absolute, this world of peace, completion, and the relative world, the world of turmoil and change and joy and sadness, a little more fluidly. Maybe one day supporting us and being able to jump off the truck, you know, and start reading poems or whatever else it is that the world asks of us. So, it's nice to be back. I hope you appreciated those thoughts. And now I feel like I've discharged my duty properly with
Shogun's essay about the four methods of guidance for the Bodhisattva. So you remember them all? Giving, kind speech, beneficial action, identity action. So basically sort of three variations on giving, and how do we identify? What are the roles that we play? What's really skillful? What's really helpful? And maybe another time I'll read you some stories from Ren, or I'll donate it to the library and you can read them yourself. Thanks very much. May our intentions equally extend.